I am so grateful to be with all of you this evening. Special gratitude to His Holiness Devamrita Swami Maharaj for his brilliant soul-searching, enlightening Harikatha. Thank you. He transformed our hormones. His words made our hormones dance. Maharaj was so beautifully speaking about not destroying the natural inclinations of the human heart, mind, and senses, but transforming them. The Srimad Bhagavatam explains that when you put water on the root of the tree, that water reaches every part of the tree. And similarly, when we focus our body, our mind, our words, our desires, our greed, our lust, and all the other things that he was discussing toward selfless service to Krishna or to God, then it has an opposite effect. Instead of entangling us in material complications, it liberates us. And just to add something to what he said, I'd like to offer some living examples throughout history, especially in Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, which illustrate this. Lord Chaitanya is Krishna. The Vedic literatures tell us that in this age of Kali, once in a day of Brahma, Krishna appears in the role of his own devotee to teach us how it's practical, accessible to everyone to achieve this greatest of all treasures, the Premadhan, the Purushartha Siromani, the jewel of love of God. There was a king named Prataparudra. He was the undisputed king of the entire Orissan province, which in those days included Andhra Pradesh and that whole area. He was called the Gajapati. He was undefeatable. Even the time when there were Mughal emperors conquering India, they could not penetrate his kingdom. In order to do that, you really have to have it together. He had armies, military, he had spies. That's what you need in those days when you have enemies all around you. He had economists. He had a massive treasury. He had laws. He had courts. And he didn't have to worry about elections. I just came from America, and everyone, everywhere, is talking about elections. And this happens every 4 years. Because really, you could be in a very powerful position, but you really don't know if you're going to have it beyond the next few years. And after 8 years, you know you're out. But in the days of these monarchs, they come in, they're king, usually when they're teenagers, and for their whole life. So King Prataparudra was a very, very talented person. Materialistically, he was topmost. But then he heard from his teacher, his guru, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that Krishna had appeared in this age of Kali as Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya was living in Jagannath Puri, which was his kingdom. Because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had such deep faith, and he had such realization of who Lord Chaitanya was, the king believed him immediately. He said, I need to meet him. Now when the king wants to meet a beggar, sannyasi, that's usually a great honor. But when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya told Lord Chaitanya that King Prataparudra wants to meet you, the Lord said, I'm a swami. And in those days, swamis didn't meet kings. Sarvabhauma said, but he's not an ordinary king. He's a saint. He's a Rajarishi. Lord Chaitanya said, still, what will people think if I'm meeting people with so much money and so much power? When this news came to Prataparudra Maharaj, he said, it's not that he had to think about it really deeply. From the core of his heart, he immediately said, then I will give up my kingdom. If my kingdom, if my being a king is an impediment to meeting the Lord today, I'll not only give it up and give up my palace, I will live in the street like a homeless person and become a beggar. That will be my greatest treasure. That will be the greatest conquest of my life. And he meant it. And all the devotees around, they were very pleased to see his sincerity, but horrified because he was such a good king. He was so fair, so honorable, so protective, and he was running the kingdom, so everyone was happy. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So they somehow or other tried to keep him as king and connect him somehow or other to get Lord Chaitanya's mercy, which they did. That's a long story. But the conclusion was, King Prataparudra used his wealth, his intelligence, his popularity, influence, everything for the purpose of pleasing the Lord, serving the Lord, and genuinely uplifting everyone's consciousness in a spirit of compassion. Because he understood nothing is mine. Everything ultimately belongs to the Supreme Lord, to Krishna. Proprietorship means control. If you own a place, people can't just say, you have to get out. But in this world, our body, our homes, our wealth, our family, our abilities, our intelligence, at any moment it could be taken away. And inevitably at death it will be taken away. So it's never really ours. It's in our care. And this is the spiritually enlightened way of seeing this world, that whatever intelligence, abilities, wealth, influence, whatever there may be, it belongs to God, to Krishna, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, and it's in my care. And let me use it in harmony with the will of the of the proprietor. That's bhakti. By using our talents and our gifts in this way, we are watering the root of the tree. And not only do we find the greatest satisfaction, but everyone. And there are so many beautiful stories about King Prataparudra, how he maintained his position, his family, his influence in pure dharma. To show the world that whatever position we are in, if we just harmonize it with the spirit of pure bhakti, it becomes the source of our own liberation and the source of liberation of the world. And then we have Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami. They were the prime minister and home minister, finance minister for the king of Bengal. They were so efficient and proficient in what they did that the king, who was a Mughal ruler at the time, he loved them like his younger brothers. He totally depended on their skills and their influence. And he literally shared the property of his kingdom with them. Their names were Dabir Khas and Sakar Malik at the time. He gave them vast tracts of land. They built palaces, beautiful lakes and forests. They had so much everything. Power, knowledge, wealth, popularity. But when they met Lord Chaitanya, they just wanted to serve him. And they left everything. They didn't take anything with them. They went to Vrindavan. And what did they wear? In order to get there, Sanatana Goswami had to be put in prison because he was leaving behind his prime minister duties. And he escaped from prison. And he was one day he's the prime minister of the whole country. And the next day he's a fugitive by his own choice. Usually you're like that because you get caught doing something. But he didn't do anything wrong. By his choice. And when Rupa and Sanatana were living in Vrindavan, instead of royal garments, they were wearing simple loincloths. Instead of living in palatial mansions, they were sleeping on the ground, on the riverbank, or in the forest, under trees. They didn't have roofs over their heads. Instead of eating fine foods, they were just begging for some dry rotis. But they were always in the highest ecstasies of love of God. But interestingly, even when they were Goswamis, the crest jewel, highest example of renunciation, they still utilized the skills and the things of this world, but without selfishness. If you go to Vrindavan, the most beautiful, ancient, architecturally magnificently designed temple in all of Vrindavan is Radha Govinda Temple. And that's even after it has been, you know, attacked by enemies over these centuries. It was built 500 years ago. It's still the most magnificent temple in Vrindavan. Hand-carved sandstone. Rupa Goswami inspired and designed that temple that still stands today. Not for himself, for the world, so that Vrindavan would be a holy place, so that millions of people for generations and generations to come would learn the art of bhakti. A, Devamrita Swami Maharaj was talking about this lust and greed for Krishna. To build a temple like that, you have to have a vision. You have to have deep desire. And Sanatana Goswami's Madan Mohan temple, to this day, 500 years later, is the very symbol of Vrindavan. Still standing. It's magnificent. And the books that they wrote, they didn't just sit around and, you know, wait till it was time to beg rotis. They were dynamic, they were empowered, they were enthusiastic, they had passion and greed for Krishna. Rupa Goswami wrote so many incredible literatures, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the Vidagdha Madhava, the Lalita Madhava, the Upadeshamrita. Dozens and dozens of books, and their nephew Jiva Goswami wrote over 100,000 Sanskrit verses. And writing these books in those days, it wasn't like cutting and pasting, you know, from the internet. You had to be enthusiastic to write a book in those days. It was intense. Just 4 days ago, I spoke at the Cambridge Union in Cambridge University, and the topic they gave me, I didn't think of it. They gave it to me. That's usually what happens in my life. It was how simple it was in the days when apples and blackberries were just fruit. And they asked me to speak on this book, The Journey Home. So I began by saying, you know, they thought of the topic because I wrote The Journey Home on an Apple computer. And this is the fruit, whatever it may be. But in those days, to write a book, you had to go out and get palm leaves. You had to climb trees and pick palm leaves. So you had to get bark from trees, and you had to process it with natural herbs and with natural, you know, the sunlight and with water. It took a lot of time to process a leaf so actually what you write on it, it's going to last. Then they had to carve with a special writing tool, carve the Sanskrit letters into the palm leaf. And then they had to get herbs from the ground that made a color and then fill in those carved marks so that it's actually like an ink from the ground. And when Lord Chaitanya saw one of the palm leaves of Rupa Goswami's writing, he started to cry. He was so amazed. He said, Rupa Goswami's handwriting is like rows of pearls. It's so beautiful, so artistic. Every single letter has such artistic value, such devotion, such thoughtfulness. And he's sitting, Vrindavan, in the summer, it gets sometimes 50 degrees Celsius. In the winter, it gets really, really cold, freezing cold. And he didn't have heater, he didn't have air conditioner, he didn't have fan. He was just under trees. It takes some serious enthusiasm and determination to write these books like that. And to build temples like that. and to excavate holy places that millions and millions of people are coming to in Vrindavan. They were the ones who excavated these places where Krishna had his leelas. So even though they were brahmachari swamis, goswamis of the highest order, still, they had such a passion. They had such a greed to serve. Their passion and their greed was compassion. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he didn't need anything. He wanted them to do all of this for the welfare of all humanity, for the welfare of all living beings, for generations and generations, centuries and all time to come. Their passion, their greed, was an expression of their love for you and for me. To give us the real treasure of life. Imagine, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, they were what's equal today to be billionaires. They left all that. And in exchange, they got a treasure that was infinitely more valuable, a treasure that was infinitely more satisfying. And what was that treasure? Prema, love for Krishna. And what is the price of that treasure? Bhakti, our sincere devotion. They were tasting it. They were feeling it. They wanted to share it with the world. They saw how the world was so much mesmerized by all the glittering things that they had. And they wanted to show the world how all these beautiful glittering things that we had, they can be used in a way that actually bring us close to the real treasure of life and don't distract us. The weapons of mass distraction are everywhere. Yes, in the renounced order, or in the worldly order of Grihastha, whatever it may be, that passion to serve with love, with devotion, with compassion is the greatest of all treasures. And it's something everyone could do. Just a few days ago in London, I spoke at the HSBC Bank. And the HSBC Bank leadership asked me to speak on the subject of the responsibility of having wealth. I didn't even have to say it. The person that introduced me said, you know, we're asking Radhanath Swami to speak on the responsibility of having wealth. And he hasn't had a checking account since 1969. And they looked at me like, oh. I had to redefine wealth a little from their perspective. It was a wonderful reception. But the person who made the closing remarks after my talk was Alfred Brush Ford, who's one of my dear godbrothers, who Srila Prabhupada named Ambarish. He's the great-grandson of Henry Ford, who's practically the founder, pioneer of the entire automobile industry as we know it today. So, people told me afterward that they said, you know, this Mr. Ford, he sounded more like a swami than you do. And I had to admit, he actually did. But he was telling these directors and CEOs, and there were many British lords that were present. He was telling them about, he spoke a lot of very realized, experienced wisdom of being in this world, but not of this world. And he was talking about how he's building this temple in glorification of Lord Chaitanya in Navadvip Mayapur. And how, you know, he's taking literally tens and tens and tens and millions of his own dollars, and how for years, even with many impediments and disappointments, he just won't give up. Because Srila Prabhupada wanted this temple as a place where people from all over the world will be able to really understand and experience the true treasure of India's Dharma, of India's spiritual culture, as Lord Chaitanya presented it. Prema Pumartha Mahan. The highest of all goals, the greatest of all treasures, is the awakening of the love for Krishna that is within the heart of every living being. And how this love for Krishna, Lord Chaitanya taught, can be realized, can be directly experienced, whoever we may be. If we understand this principle of yukta vairagya, how to utilize the gifts of this world in a spirit of seva, unselfish service, rather than selfish egoism, by watering the root of the tree. And how we can actually have this experience awaken in our heart if we learn the art, the science of chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada was a Goswami like Rupa and Sanatan. He had nothing himself. He knew he would never see this temple to live in it. He was already in his late 70s when he gave Alfred Ford the instruction, please build this temple for the world so that millions and millions of people from everywhere will come to really to associate with people who can present the science of Sanatan Dharma, pure bhakti, and convince their hearts. Experience the treasure of this holy place. So since Srila Prabhupada has left 1977, Ambarish has been working and working and working, and now the temple, he's already put tens and millions of dollars. He's put about 30 years of practically his full attention. And you know what I was thinking? When he was speaking, I was thinking that Alfred Brush Ford has as much passion and greed to build this temple for Lord Chaitanya as his great-grandfather had to build Ford cars. It's a fact. It's very, very practical. It's very simple. Devamrita Maharaj was talking about the brahmacharis being so enthusiastic with such strong desires. But the household ladies and gentlemen of our congregation have the same intense, strong desires. Some are industrialists, some are software engineers, some are students, some are professors, some are into engineering or politics, whatever it may be. Bhakti is a change of heart. And expressing that change of heart in such a way that we can not only transform ourselves, our families, but we can be instruments in helping to transform the world, to find the real fulfillment that everyone is seeking, that connection with the all-beautiful, all-sweet, supreme personality of Godhead. Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna Maharaji, Hare Krishna Maharaji, Devamrit Swami Maharaj, Narol pranams to you all. My question was, during Devamrit Maharaji's lecture, you described what are materialists, that whatever more people around us have, they are the materialists. So, but even in this hall, there are so many people who have more than each one of us. So how do you actually justify the correct meaning?
For those in material consciousness, they distinguish like that. They always feel that their own material desires are justified and normal, and the problems in the world are caused by others. So they're always looking at others and putting the blame there without looking at their own self. But when you refer to persons who have gathered here, obviously, they're not ordinary persons. So much so that whether they have a little money or countless monies, if they are using what they have in Krishna's service, they are a different kind of person altogether. And even they may not have yet progressed to that level of bhakti, but just by thinking to do this or considering the possibility, they're also very special persons. All right.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. I have a question that when we... Hare Krishna. So when I deal with my colleagues, who are from different religions. So I want to tell them about our religions or about Krishna. So they try to ignore the thing that he is a supreme personality of Godhead. So how to deal with such person? Because I want to tell him about that he is about Krishna, I want to tell him. So how do I tell them that they ignore me? I don't want that. Krishna should be ignored. So how should I deal with them?
I already spoke. I already spoke.
Has anyone else ever had that experience? When Srila Prabhupada came to the Lower East Side of New York, practically not a single person even heard the word Krishna before. Srila Prabhupada had two qualities that were very convincing. One is he really, really deeply cared to give this gift of Krishna to us. And he had conviction. To the degree we actually really understand and experience Krishna, we understand the value of who Krishna is. And then it's not just a ritual trying to convince somebody, but it's our compassion for them, our love for Krishna and Prabhupada, we want to share this most valuable jewel of Krishna with them. And if we have that understanding, that conviction, that compassion, then Krishna empowers us to speak in a way that we could actually reach their hearts. Somehow or other, to connect them with Krishna. Sometimes Prabhupada would just make that connection by giving someone a gulab jamun. And saying, please come back. In so many words, he was saying, I love you. Here's my love in the form of a gulab jamun. And their hearts would open to think, oh, he's such a wonderful man. I want to understand what he means. And then when the philosophy actually came, their hearts were open. So we have to open people's hearts by our love, by our kindness. And then we have to present the truth with the power of the truth behind it by simply presenting it as it is. And that combination actually works miracles. Does that kind of answer your question? Thank you.
Hare Krishna Mataji. This is question to Malati Devi Mataji. Mataji, you are saying about enthusiasm, determination and patience for getting success in spiritual life. But somehow or other we are getting these things only in material concept. Whenever we are trying to achieve some material success, we have enthusiasm, determination. But when we try to engage the same thing in spiritual life, we are thinking that this thing is decreasing. So how you are able to maintain this much enthusiasm for your whole life and serving Prabhupada? So please kindly enlighten us with your experience and your determination about that.
Srila Radhanath Maharaj used the word conviction in wanting to share Krishna consciousness with others. You must be convinced. And in wanting to remain determined, enthusiastic, and patient, you must also be convinced. Srila Prabhupada would often make this remark, so are you convinced? He would present some argument and he said, so are you convinced? All the devotees would go, Jai Prabhupada, and he said, then do it. But there has to be the determination, and it has to be uninterrupted. Just like we understand devotional service is uninterrupted and unmotivated, but we need some motivation in the initial endeavor. And for many people, that motivation is simply some relief from the material frustration and anxiety. But even that will not keep you in line unless you get some taste for Krishna consciousness. And Krishna alone can award that taste. I was reading one small purport from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and in that Prabhupada expressed, in order to get Krishna's mercy, one has to serve Krishna with affection. We can serve Krishna out of duty or with awe and veneration, but it doesn't have the effect as serving Krishna with affection. So somehow or other, if you can make, in your beginning stages of Krishna consciousness, some attempt at affectionate service for Krishna, you'll receive some reciprocation in the form of Krishna's mercy. And that will give you further impetus to remain determined, to remain enthusiastic, and to remain patient, not expecting overnight miracle. Although in fact, it is an overnight miracle. Anytime we chant the holy name, there is an effect, whether or not we perceive it. Hare Krishna.
Prabhuji, actually you said mode of ignorance and passion, they cannot be neglected. But can you set some unique example for that?
Can you explain, please? Mode of passion and mode of ignorance cannot be neglected? I was explaining how the standard, unfortunately, for the world today is basically passion and ignorance. Passion means intense striving for material goals, which inevitably will lead to dissatisfaction, frustration, anger, wrath, and to seek relief from material frustration, what the world offers is intoxication, which is the mode of ignorance. So basically, in a nutshell, unfortunately, that is the predominant current of the world. After all, this is Kali Yuga. So once you understand that that is the general thrust of the material setting today, you begin to wonder, aren't I meant for something better than that? And indeed, people are starting to wonder. They can't find a way, a satisfactory way, out of the world's economic problems, for example. There's no room for more growth, for more economic growth. But without economic growth, how can society as it's known go on? And as I explained, or tried to explain, even if there is unlimited, even if there are unlimited resources in the world for consumption, and even if there's unlimited room in the world to dispose of the waste from the consumption, so that means everyone could just desire, desire, want, get. Even if they could do that, they still wouldn't be satisfied. So many persons are starting to understand that. But what is the alternative? One famous economist at Columbia University is proposing that since the world cannot handle any more economic expansion without destroying itself, we need that people, he was speaking particularly about the USA, we need people to develop virtues again, virtues of moderation, cooperation, compassion. So then his critics asked him, well, your economics are brilliant, but can you please tell us how the people are supposed to suddenly develop compassion, cooperation, and moderation? And he just admitted, that's not my department. So people are starting to ask such questions. Where do the ethics come from? Another famous economist, said that basically the economic issues facing humanity today are moral issues. And economists don't know how to deal with that. So many persons are starting to look in the right direction. They've seen that the mode of passion, mode of ignorance, civilization is destructive. Destructive of the individual. The number two disease in the world is now mental depression. Right behind heart disease. So people are looking at the environment. They're looking at the state of the mind. They're looking at the social fabric of society. And they're wondering, what will put things into another direction? So there are persons who are considering such things. And indeed, just look at all the new faces that came tonight for the first time to this Prerana festival. They're coming because they're looking for something higher. They want something better in their life than just the passion of ignorance. So they're voting with their feet. They're coming here. And they're hearing. And who can say what their future will be? So there are things happening in a positive way in this world. And of course, Krishna is the supreme positive. In bhakti, everything is positive and possible. All right?
Hare Krishna, Dandavat Maharaj. I wanted to ask that, you know, sometimes it is seen in the devotee's life that devotion after a couple of years or 3 years, it gets stagnant or choked up. So, like, it is like, and you have asked us to consider this life, I mean, the devotional life to fulfill the...
Can you kindly raise your hand, please, who's speaking?
To fulfill the inner self, that is what you asked us to consider, this kind of life, devotional life. So, like, even in the Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, it is seen that Krishna asked, Lord Chaitanya said that people's life getting flooded with the ocean of love and everything. But it's practically very difficult to see in a person's life how it is practically happening, because it is very difficult to see. So my question is, like, when we have to consider this kind of life, after seeing this experience in other people, other devotees' life, how do we consider it?
It sounds like the question is concerned with the possibility that after a few years of investing in devotional service, things won't turn out the way that you hoped and your situation will start to feel stale and diminishing. Am I understanding your question? Everything we do in life, whether material or spiritual, involves proper technique and proper guidance. Even if you want to have some material goal, you try to get the best guidance that's out there. And you make sure that your approach, your technique, is correct. The same principles are there in spiritual life. Service to Krishna, the Krishna conscious career, is nothing ordinary, of course. This career requires guidance so that our technique is proper. If we plug into the wisdom culture that offers guidance, tutelage, on-the-job training, then our bhakti efforts are certain to remain free from the perception of staleness and withering and diminishing. Withering, diminishing, staleness are material qualities. If we have proper guidance, and proper guidance is the greatest luxury. If you are part of a community, a spiritual community that offers guidance, you can consider yourself to be very wealthy. And if you take advantage of that guidance, your bhakti development will remain on track. So this paranoia is legitimate. This fear is legitimate, but it's based on not yet fully realizing the advantages that Krishna will provide you. The wealth of guidance that Krishna will make available. By tapping into that wealth, that wisdom culture, the guidance, the luxurious guidance, you can pass over all those possible obstacles of material consciousness. Okay?
Hare Krishna. So let us express our deepest and sincerest gratitude to His Holiness Devamrita Swami Maharaj and His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj, Her Grace Malati Devi Prabhu. Let us express our deepest gratitude to all of them. All of them are traveling to Tirupati tomorrow morning for the GBC meetings, yet they have made their time available this evening in spite of their hectic busy schedules. Let us express our gratitude by loudly chanting, Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! At this point of time, I would like to request all the devotees and guests to rise for Kirtan. Hare Krishna.